Spiked is free, and it always will be. There's no paywall, no subscriptions. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to do that, we need your help. If you support the work that we do here, why not become a regular donor? Just £5 per month will keep us going, even in these uncertain times. To do so, just go to spiked-online.com and click on the big red donate button. Whatever you can give is greatly appreciated, especially given all that's going on in the world. Thanks so much, and now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast. My name's Tom Slater, and this is the show where myself and Chris Snowden usually discuss all the latest news in a liberalism and the nanny state with the help of an invited guest. But for the moment, we're only really talking about one thing, the coronavirus crisis. In this episode, with the help of Toby Young, we discuss the rights and wrongs of lockdown, the bungling response of the WHO, and whether nicotine is the miracle treatment we've all been waiting for. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, and today, as ever, I'm joined by Chris Snowden, Director of Lifestyle Economics at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tom.
And we're also delighted to be joined today by Toby Young. Toby is the Associate Editor of The Spectator, and most pertinently for today's discussion, the man behind a new website, a new project called Lockdown Skeptics, bringing together dissenting voices on this crucial issue, which can be found at lockdownskeptics.org. Toby, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks, Tom.
So to kick things off, let's talk about that topic. Let's talk about lockdowns. We're about a month into the lockdown in the UK, brought in an effort to suppress the coronavirus outbreak here. The government recently extended it for another 3 weeks. Most people assume we're going to be in this for much longer. And while we've already heard the health secretary say this week that we're past the peak, evidence of the costs of the lockdown to the economy, the knock-on effects for health appear to be mounting. And all the while, we're still kind of grasping for hard evidence as to whether or not this is the path that we should all be taking. So what I want to get into is the lockdown doing what it set out to do? And is it worth it in terms of the other harms it may be inflicting on society, both at the moment, but in the long term? How do we assess that? How do we make that trade-off? So Toby, I want to start with you. You found yourself, not for the first time, I think it's fair to say, in a Twitter kind of acid bath over a piece that you wrote on all of this recently. So you've called for the lockdown to be eased as soon as possible, really. What's your core argument here?
Yeah, well, my core argument started out being an argument about the likely loss of life as a result of prolonging the lockdown, because it would do so much damage to the economy. And there is quite a lot of evidence that economic contractions cause things like suicides to increase domestic violence, increase violent crime, murder, and so forth. But I've now got, I think, a stronger argument, which is that if you look at the infection rate and death tolls in those countries which have lockdown, they don't seem to be any lower than in those countries which haven't. And there doesn't seem to be any correlation between the infection rate and the death rate, and when countries impose lockdowns in the life cycle of epidemics, and how severe those lockdowns are. In fact, there was a piece published in Spiked by the Associate Professor of Political Science at Kentucky State University, Wilfred Riley, making precisely that argument. He looked at the different rates of infection, the different death tolls in various American states, some of which have imposed lockdowns, others of which haven't, to see if he could detect any correlation. And he couldn't. The death toll, the rate of infection, doesn't vary according to whether or not a country's locked down and how severely it's locked down, if it has, and when it locked down, if it has. And the classic kind of counterexample to those who think lockdowns are saving tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of lives, is Sweden. Sweden hasn't closed bars, hasn't closed restaurants, gatherings of up to 50 people are still permitted. Schools for those aged 16 and under are still open. And I think the death rate per million in Sweden is about 140, 150, whereas the death rate per million in the UK, which did lock down, of course, on March 23rd, is around 220, 230. And to those who complain that the UK didn't lock down sooner and that Boris should have his feet held to the fire because of the high UK death toll, Belgium locked down a week before, or 5 days before, the UK did. And the death rate per million in Belgium is somewhere in the region of 450, almost twice as large as that of the UK. So there just doesn't seem to be a correlation between whether or not you lock down and your death toll and infection rate. And I think that's quite a strong argument, therefore, for scaling back the lockdown. And in other countries in the world, that's happening. Spain, Italy, France, Germany, Norway, Denmark, they've all announced exit plans. The United States, of course, not every state is locked down in the US. It's up to individual governors. But nonetheless, Donald Trump has announced an exit strategy for those states that have locked down. And the UK is looking increasingly like an outlier. I hope last week when Dominic Raab announced the extension for another 3 weeks of the lockdown, that he would also talk about the exit strategy. And the following day, there did seem to be some stories. Last weekend, there were some stories saying that the hawks in the cabinet who want to dial down the lockdown were in the ascendant and the doves were gradually losing ground. And I think there was various speculation about when schools would be open. In the Sunday Times, I think it said that on May the 8th, schools would start to go back. But then those stories were quite quickly quashed the following day with the news that Boris himself is leaning towards the doves. So it doesn't look like there's any end in sight at the moment. And given the catastrophic economic damage with all the implications that follow from that, that we know is resulting from the lockdown, it just seems crazy not to at least start talking about how to dial it down.
Chris, what's your take on all of this?
Well, I remember Toby writing that article. I don't know, it was probably only about 2 weeks ago. Everything moves so slowly these days. And I was glad he did. And I said I was glad he did on Twitter. I was thinking about writing something similar just because I thought it was worth having the conversation about the cost to the economy and to lives. You know, there are trade-offs in these things. And surely it stands to reason that at some point, closing down most of the economy is going to be more costly than allowing additional deaths, if you like. And of course, Toby got monstered for that, as he so often does on Twitter. I don't know why he seems to attract quite so much vitriol. But I think really the country just didn't seem quite ready to have that conversation. But within a few days, there were plenty of other people making the same kind of arguments and not getting any abuse for it whatsoever. And it was, of course, a perfectly reasonable question to raise. And I disagreed with the use of some of the figures in that particular article. But that's not really the point. The point is one of principle. You know, are we prepared to do absolutely everything or anything in order to save one life? And some of the people responding were saying, well, life is priceless. You can't put a price on a human life. Governments put a price on a human life all the time. And we would waste enormous amounts of money trying to prolong, you know, a 90-year-old's life by one day if we didn't. So I think it was very much a point worth making. And as time goes on, I think more and more people are coming around to the same way of thinking as people, you know, run out of money and jobs start to go and businesses start to fold. I've never been a hawk or a dove on the lockdown issue. And my feeling still is that this 3 week extension is probably about right. And I say that mostly because I think it's critical that we avoid a second wave. I think the country can just about withstand 6 weeks of this. It's going to be very serious damage and a lot of debt, but I think it won't be catastrophic. Whereas I think if we had to do all this again, it would be. And I don't think at the moment we can feel confident of avoiding a second wave because we just haven't got the diagnostic tests. So I'm kind of in favor, reluctantly, of the extension because it allows us to buy more time to get the testing and tracing equipment and technology in place so that we can stamp out any future outbreaks. But like Toby, I am very interested in what's happening in some of these other countries. And it doesn't make a lot of sense to me that a country that disregards a lockdown like Sweden would not see exponential growth in deaths, but they just haven't. And like a lot of people, I've been looking at these statistics obsessively day after day. And yes, Sweden is doing worse than the other Nordic countries in terms of daily deaths, but the numbers are still very small and they're not rising exponentially. And I can't explain that. And I think there's a few things happening that people can't explain. I've been looking at Belarus's figures for what they're worth. Belarus famously is not taking this at all seriously, or at least its government isn't. The prime minister said it was basically nothing to worry about and people should drink vodka. But their peak in deaths happened on the 6th of April, I think, when five people died. And it's been kind of three or four people every day since then. Nicaragua, which is the kind of the most extreme control group, where they, I think, had a parade to celebrate coronavirus a few weeks ago, they've had two deaths during the entire outbreak. So I do find this difficult to understand. It seems to me from the UK figures that we had a peak around about 3 weeks after the lockdown came in. So that kind of makes sense. And it makes logical sense that we've suppressed the infections. But there, I think there are, at the very least, some very interesting questions to answer as we learn more about this. And people shouldn't be shouted down for asking them.
Not at all. I mean, on that point, because, Toby, you know, you started kind of laying out all of the different examples, and one of the things that it felt like in the run-up to the lockdown, there was this incredible sense of certainty, particularly on the side of the press and people agitating for this to happen, that this was definitely the right road to go down. But even now, do you think there's been a kind of failure to admit that we just don't really know how a lot of this is going to pan out, that there's so many variables at play, so many different societies? Sweden is a very different society to Britain in terms of the things that are going on. Is that one thing that we have to kind of accept going into all of this, is that we are making judgments as we go, but we don't have the data yet, and we also haven't quite been able to get a sense of how all of these different factors play into how an outbreak's going to pan out?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, Tom. I think there's certainly a good deal of uncertainty about the virus, about the course it typically takes, about what the infection fatality rate is, how many people have been infected and so forth. And there's a huge amount of debate taking place about that, in some cases at quite a high level. But I don't think that the precautionary principle dictates that because we're in unknown territory, we therefore should lock down and enforce extreme social distancing measures. Because after all, we know, even though we don't know how effective those lockdowns are, we do know how destructive it's going to be, how destructive it's already been of the economy. And we do know that in due course, that will eventually cost lives. So I'm not sure that even though there is uncertainty, that the precautionary principle dictates a lockdown. Just to respond to something Chris said, I'm reasonably confident, though I couldn't claim to know, that if we do end the lockdown, we won't face a rise in infections which overwhelms the NHS, partly because the NHS has ramped up its capacity, its critical care capacity, quite significantly in the past 3 or 4 weeks. We know this because every day in the papers we read about hospitals being half empty. Some of the Nightingale hospitals that have been built now aren't going to be used. Very few of the beds in the Nightingale Hospital that's been built in the EdXcel are being used, the XL. I think that even if we did see an uptick in infections after loosening some of the social distancing measures, I don't think the NHS would be overwhelmed. So I don't think it would be catastrophic and we'd have to impose another lockdown. But I think we shouldn't postpone lifting the lockdown until we can be certain we won't have to reimpose some of those restrictions, which seems to be the test the government has set itself and the one that Dominic Raab and Boris Johnson are saying they're going to apply. I think that's wrong because given the uncertainty, I think it's going to be a long time before we can say with complete confidence that there wouldn't need to be some restrictions reimposed after we lift the lockdown. So that means prolonging the lockdown for an awfully long time. Surely it's less risky to lift the restrictions. If we do have to reimpose them, then let's reimpose them. But that won't be an absolute catastrophe. Much more catastrophic would be postponing the end of the lockdown until we have complete certainty about that, or until we have a vaccine, which could easily be another 18 months.
So what puzzles me about this whole thing, and the mystery gets deeper every day, is it seems to be such an infectious disease or at least that's how it appeared initially. You know, you get literally one or two people with it in a country, and before you know it, thousands and thousands of people got it all around the country. It is spread around the entire world. Virtually every country has got it in a very short space of time. And for that reason, a lockdown seems almost the only option, given that it is relatively lethal. And yet, in Sweden, where they've more or less encouraged the spread of it, we're getting 150 deaths a day. I mean, kind of maximum, and it doesn't seem to be going up much more than that. I'm really puzzled by the fact that every country seems to have a pretty similar kind of typical epidemic curve. And yes, the UK is higher than a lot of countries, and Sweden's higher than the other Nordic countries, and some countries like Germany are lower. But it, as you say, Toby, it doesn't seem directly related to either the severity of the lockdown or whether they even had a lockdown at all. And I'm still inclined to err on the side of caution, because I am worried that because it's so infectious, the second wave would just be as bad at least as the first one. But I think there's so much more we have to learn about this, and we might find out that perhaps we have overreacted in hindsight.
One theory, Chris, which there seems to be an increasing amount of evidence for, and this isn't a theory put forward by cranks and crackpots. This is a theory put forward by pretty senior scientists, like the chief scientific advisor to the Swedish government, the chief scientific advisor to the Finnish government, the professor of medicine at Stanford, the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine at Oxford. The theory that seems to be emerging is that the percentage of the population where the virus has struck that's been infected is far higher than we initially thought, and that therefore the infection fatality rate is actually a lot lower than we originally thought, and certainly a lot lower than the case fatality rate, which is the number of people who've tested positive divided by the number of people who've succumbed to the disease. And according to the team at Stanford, who recently carried out some research in Santa Clara County and discovered that the number of people infected was between, I think, 55 and 80 times greater than originally estimated. And according to the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine at Oxford and various others, the infection fatality rate is somewhere between 0.1 and 0.2% of the population. Some put it a little bit higher, but not much higher, which is only a little bit more deadly than seasonal flu. And if that's the case, then all these lockdowns and the economic damage they'll cause has largely been unnecessary. But it also means that if we end the lockdowns, chances are most people in most countries have already been exposed to the virus. We're well on our way to already obtaining herd immunity, which is why we won't see a huge rise in new infections if we end the lockdown.
And I hope that is true. I really do. And as with so many things with this, you see completely different opposing bits of evidence here or there. I've seen some reasonably respectable looking studies suggesting there's been a huge rate of transmission, and others saying there's been hardly any at all. I mean, I think we should all hope. I think you'd be mad not to hope that Sweden has got it right, not only basic kind of humanitarian terms, but just because the rest of the world can breathe a sigh of relief. And it is too early to say, but I have spent the last few weeks, you know, to people who've been saying Sweden got it right, saying, well, let's wait another week, and let's wait another week. And it hasn't taken off like I expected it to.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. Next up, let's talk a bit about the World Health Organization. So last week, US President Donald Trump announced he was going to pull the funding to the WHO, the UN Public Health Agency, over its handling of the coronavirus pandemic. He's accused it of mismanaging the crisis, assisting China effectively in covering up the initial outbreak. And this comes, you know, amid a lot of questions being raised about the organization and it potentially cozying up to China. Still, Trump's move has obviously inevitably caused shock and horror in the West. Trump very much accused of just trying to deflect attention from his own mishandlings. But what we want to talk about today is, might you have a point about the WHO? Chris, you wrote an article to that effect the other week. How could you say such a thing, that Trump might actually be right about something in this instance?
Because it should be possible to keep two ideas in your head at the same time. You know, yes, Trump is doing this to deflect attention from his own handling of COVID-19 and saying it was a hoax and so on. But at the same time, he happens to be right, possibly for the wrong reasons, about this. And the WHO is a horror show. People who have watched it for years, rather than just paying attention to it every now and again when we get the kind of crisis we've got now, have seen its myriad faults, and not just the WHO, actually various other elements of the United Nations, but the WHO in particular is flawed in so many ways. This is not the first time it's dropped the ball on infectious disease, for a start off, and it is supposed to be there primarily to deal with epidemics and pandemics. It did not cover itself in glory on Ebola by any means. It hasn't really handled a major epidemic of infectious disease very well since SARS, which was over 15 years ago. And it is now being shown to have been bizarrely craven towards the Chinese Communist Party for reasons I still don't understand. But it has gone well beyond just using diplomatic language. And I've heard it said that, you know, the WHO doesn't have spies in China and it can't tell if the Chinese are lying or not, and the fault ultimately lies with the Chinese. Well, yeah, the fault does ultimately lie with the Chinese for covering this whole thing up. But if you look at the timeline of what the WHO have been doing, there were plenty of independent scientists in early to mid-January who could see, for example, that there was human-to-human transmission, and the WHO was saying there wasn't. Even as late as February, the WHO was still casting doubts on that when it was undeniable, really. It was fairly obvious to anybody who knew anything about it that there was human-to-human transmission. And then it then decided to flatter China by praising it for its transparency and saying how wonderful, how open the organization had been and so on. So I think the WHO's complicity with China on this did definitely cost lives and certainly allowed the virus to spread much more quickly than it otherwise would have done. And one of the reasons WHO is so hopeless in this regard is not only the fact that it has some fairly low-grade people in top positions, not only the fact that it is financially corrupt, certainly has been embroiled in plenty of expenses, scandals, but that it is obsessed with issues that have nothing to do with contagious diseases. I think we probably talked before on the podcast about his obsession with vaping in particular, but also tobacco control in general, and putting out messaging around sugary drinks. Even recently, last week, they were telling people who were locked down, you know, don't consume more than 6 teaspoons of sugar a day and all this kind of stuff. They're obsessed with these issues that are mainly only of interest to kind of very left-wing public health academics or rich donors like Mike Bloomberg. And as a result, they cannot do their job properly. And on the Trump thing, the only way you're going to get reform is by threatening to take the money away. That's the bottom line. And yeah, maybe it's not great timing in some respects to do it during a pandemic, but in another way, it's a perfect time to do it because it's the only time people are paying any attention to the WHO. Once this pandemic is finished, people will ignore the WHO like they normally do, and the same people will still be in charge next time we have an epidemic like this to deal with.
Toby, what's your thoughts?
I wanted to add to Chris's litany of errors committed by the WHO since the outbreak of the pandemic. The WHO actually praised China for its response to the epidemic in China. It said, you know, the Chinese authorities' management of the crisis was a model. Let's not forget that one of the things the Chinese authorities did when some Chinese doctors in Wuhan first raised the alarm about this pneumonia-like virus was to arrest them, lock them up, and then force them to sign confessions that they'd been effectively spreading fake news. Another thing that the Chinese authorities did after testing everyone, anyone who tested positive for COVID-19 was effectively imprisoned in a hospital, whether they required hospital care or not. They were quarantined, unable to leave these large hospitals, which the Chinese authorities knocked up really quickly. But in addition, anyone who tested negative was walled in to their apartment. They weren't allowed to leave their homes. Food was delivered by the police. I mean, the idea that that kind of response, which is only possible in a totalitarian society like China's, is a model that the rest of the world should be following, it's just completely absurd. And let's not forget that incredibly embarrassing exchange between Bruce Albiard, one of the assistant directors of the WHO, and a Hong Kong broadcaster, in which Bruce was asked why it was that the WHO had effectively still not admitted Taiwan. Well, we all know the answer is because China don't want the WHO to recognize Taiwan. And instead of answering the question, he fell back on that old sore of pretending he hadn't heard it and pretending he'd been disconnected. The video of it was quite funny. But the WHO has just covered itself in shame throughout this crisis.
And Chris, you spoke a little bit there about, you know, the kind of litany of failures of the WHO over the years, but also just becoming an increasingly ridiculous organization, you know, suggesting that Syria should look into plain packaging of tobacco in 2016 whilst it was riven by civil war, you know, praising North Korea for bringing down obesity rates and making Robert Mugabe a goodwill ambassador. So there's a lot of kind of ridiculous things that have gone on over the years. But I guess my question is there a kind of salvageable organization in there? Is there something that you could see that could be positive in terms of playing that role of trying to coordinate responses when you are faced with a genuine public health crisis rather than these just kind of Western obsesses and fripperies?
Possibly, because most of the people on the front line working for the WHO, most of the scientists, I'm sure, are excellent. And so it could quite conceivably, if it just got back to its knitting, as it were, become a great global organization committed to eradicating infectious diseases. It's done fantastic things in the past. You know, for the entire 20th century, as long as it was around, it was doing great work. It's only really been the last 10, 15 years where it's been distracted by these stupid nanny state and lifestyle regulatory issues. I mean, the Mugabe thing, in a way, is beyond belief. And I think about it a lot because, or what planet do you have to be on to think that making Robert Mugabe a goodwill ambassador of the WHO is in any way a good idea, and something that's not going to go down terribly with the general public? It suggests that it is so far removed from reality and sanity that maybe it can't be reformed. Maybe it has to be replaced. But I think that is possible, you know. The US gives it 15% of its money. We give it a big chunk of money. You know, on a per capita basis, we're its biggest funder as a state. Bill Gates is the second biggest funder overall. You know, if just the US and Britain and Bill Gates got together and said, we want to set up a decent WHO like the WHO used to be, we could do that. Maybe there could be a bit of competition between the two for a while, but you know, the Gates US UK organization could be entirely focused on spotting new viral threats and dealing with them, and the WHO can carry on hectoring people about sugary drinks and vaping and make Putin its goodwill ambassador.
And Toby, what are your thoughts on all this? Do you think, you know, we've also seen a bit in the UK with our own kind of nanny state establishment, Public Health England, you know, again, coming in for a lot of criticism, having spent years focusing on all of this nanny state stuff, not really stepping up to the plate in relation to testing or other things. I mean, do you think there's going to be more of a reckoning with a lot of the nanny state stuff that has been so preoccupying so many of these organisations for so long?
Well, I think there is certainly going to be a lengthy post-mortem when the crisis is over. I'm sure at least one and probably more public inquiries costing the taxpayer tens of millions of pounds. And that will rumble on and ripple through our politics for years to come and will probably be one of the dominant themes of the next general election in 2024. One of the disappointing things about the government's response to coronavirus has been the willingness of the British public and the British media to just go along with it and not challenge it, as well as their extraordinary ferocity attacking anyone who does dissent from the consensus. Insofar as the media has been at all critical of the government's handling of this crisis, it's criticised the government not for imposing a lockdown, but for having not imposed a lockdown even sooner, which is very disappointing. But the reaction of the public, I mean, the British, you know, we like to think of ourselves as a nation of, you know, Rabelaisian freedom lovers who value our kind of inalienable right to go to the pub more highly than almost anything else. And yet we seem to have gone along with the suspension of those rights without so much as a murmur. Indeed, if you look at some of the opinion polling, a majority of the British public think that the restrictions aren't severe enough and are quite cross when they see people jogging and cycling and sort of walking their dogs in the local park and think they should be placed under complete house arrest rather than virtual house arrest. So that's been very disappointing, particularly when you compare the reaction of the supposedly liberty-loving Brits to their German counterparts. There have been kind of protests in cities like Berlin. There have been protests in Belgium. There have been protests in places like Michigan, Ohio, across the United States. In Michigan, even some of the local sheriffs joined a protest, you know, very different from the reaction to our own constabulary, who've been only too eager to try and enforce some of the authoritarian edicts handed down by Matt Hancock and others. So I think one of the things we're going to have to reevaluate when this is all over is, are we a freedom-loving people after all? I think in some ways we sort of we flattered ourselves that we are this kind of race of unconquerable kind of yeomen because we haven't been invaded since 1066. So we can tell ourselves this is true. But, you know, had Hitler not paused after the fall of Dunkirk, but pressed on, you know, perhaps we would have been even more supine than some of the other peoples conquered by the Nazi war machine. You know, if you look at the way in which the residents of the Channel Islands behaved when the Nazis invaded, it doesn't exactly fill you with confidence that, you know, the residents of Guildford and, you know, Little Snoring would have behaved any better.
Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do so, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show. So on that start note, let's move on to our final topic of the show. And the question that everyone's asking is nicotine the miracle COVID-19 treatment we've all been waiting for? So just before we started recording, news broke. Chris sent around the link that French researchers are planning to test nicotine patches on coronavirus patients and frontline health staff after a study suggested smokers may be much less at risk of contracting the virus. There's been various reports from the US and China and elsewhere that smokers are underrepresented among COVID-19 patients. On the other side, of course, there's been many people still insisting that smoking raises the risks. But what's the truth in all this is what we're going to try and talk about a little bit. So, Chris, kick us off. What have researchers found out about smoking and coronavirus and nicotine so far?
Well, it's been very exciting from my point of view, and I've been reluctant to endorse it too much because I keep fearing that it's going to all fall apart. This is what I call the banter hypothesis, that smoking is the only thing that actually protects you from coronavirus. But as the days go on and more bits of research come out, it really does start to look like that. So it started off when a scientist called Constantine Farsalonis over in Athens, who's primarily an e-cigarette researcher, he started looking at the studies come out of China. And he noticed something that is actually quite obvious once you start looking for it, which is that smokers are hugely underrepresented. These are all studies in hospitals, and there just didn't seem to be very many of them. The smoking rate in China is about 27%, and in the hospitals, it was kind of 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6%, which is telling, but I mean, this is only raw data, so I didn't read too much into it. And then evidence came out of the USA where the proportion of current smokers in coronavirus wards is 1.3%. And even the proportion of former smokers, given that about 40% of the US population, I think, are former smokers, is about 2.5%. So again, massively underrepresented. And then the most compelling evidence came from New York, where a proper epidemiological study had been put together. And that too found that the proportion of smokers was way below what you would expect, particularly for a respiratory disease, you know? And then evidence from France and indeed Germany. And in fact, everywhere where they actually take note of whether the patients are smokers or not, which the UK doesn't for some weird reason, has shown the same thing. And the latest study you allude to there is from France. And as a result, French researchers are going to start doing some research into nicotine. Now, I don't understand the science of this, and I'm not even going to try to understand it because I think a little knowledge is probably a dangerous thing. But I gather there are sensible, rational, biological reasons why having some nicotine in your blood would help protect you, if not necessarily from getting the virus, then from becoming critically ill. That something in nicotine activates enzymes that help you fight it off. So, I mean, it's hilarious, let's face it, because Public Health England came out very quickly claiming that smokers are 14 times more likely to become critically ill with coronavirus if they develop the disease, based on a study of 5 smokers in China out of about 100. So again, they were straight away, they were underrepresented in the hospital, of whom 3 became critically ill. But there's, as always, PHE is cherry picking the evidence. Most of the studies don't even imply that. And you can't read anything into such a small study in the first place. But they're on the record now saying that smokers are vastly more likely to become critically ill with coronavirus, while all the other evidence points in the other direction. And serious researchers are now taking this as a serious proposition. And I hope they're right. And on a Thursday night, we can all clap for our cigarettes.
Clap for big tobacco. Toby, what are your thoughts on all this?
It may be that if we look at the people who've succumbed to coronavirus, that Chris can find some ammunition there to prosecute his ongoing war against the anti-smoking Nazis. But I've got some bad news for him, which is that something like between 65 and 70% of those who've died of COVID-19 in the UK, and I think in other parts of the world too, are overweight. And I'm afraid that we're not going to hear very much about whatever benefits smoking has as a defense against the virus. But I think we're going to hear an awful lot once the crisis is over about just how greater your risk of succumbing was if you were overweight. But I think more seriously, I'm not terribly optimistic that we will develop a vaccine for the virus, at least not within the next 18 months, which is why I think a strategy of essentially keeping the lockdown in place until a vaccine is available, or at least insisting that elderly people and the vulnerable self-isolate until a vaccine becomes available. I don't think that's realistic because I'm not confident there will be a vaccine, not within the next 18 months. But I do think that there's greater reason for hope about finding ways to successfully treat the disease and managing the risk via more and more effective treatments. And, we know, I think, what the obvious candidates are. There's hydroxychloroquine. Trump, of course, flagged this up a few weeks ago. And for that reason, lots of people poo-poo the benefits of hydroxychloroquine as both a prophylactic and a means of treating COVID-19. But the evidence that seems to be emerging is that it is an effective treatment. It's already on the treatment protocol of Massachusetts General Hospital and in other major teaching hospitals in the US. Remdesivir, I think it's called. I might be mispronouncing that, which is one of the antivirals used for treating HIV. There have been some cases of that proving an effective treatment of COVID-19. Head lice shampoo, that was one of the more unexpected effective treatments. I remember reading something about that in the papers a couple of weeks ago.
Do you drink it? Or
No. I think just if you've used it, supposedly, you're less likely to succumb to coronavirus. So I do think whether smoking finds its way onto the Massachusetts General Hospital's protocol for treating coronavirus remains to be seen. But I do think as the pandemic unfolds, we are going to discover more and more effective ways of treating it. And that will be a key part of managing it once we've lifted the lockdowns.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And, at this moment in time, the only tried and tested proven remedy is the cigarette. But to make things even better, of course, British American Tobacco are working on a vaccine. I didn't know this, but BAT have a vaccine program year-round. They work on seasonal flu vaccines. They developed a vaccine for Ebola. And they seem quite confident they can develop a vaccine for COVID-19. So it would just make all my dreams come true if it turns out that cigarettes are a prophylactic for COVID-19 and BAT come up with the vaccine, which the WHO has to endorse and hand out all around the world. I mean, just things just can't get any better from my point of view at the moment. I thought the banter era was over, and the coronavirus thing was so depressing initially, but it could have such a happy ending. I don't know how public health will ever recover if BAT develop the vaccine and cigarettes cure coronavirus.
I think that's a perfect place to end it. Chris, Toby, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to help support Spiked to keep us making this podcast and all our other podcasts, as well as our daily articles and essays, then please do consider making a donation. It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit that big red donate button in the top right corner. Anything you can spare is greatly appreciated. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.